Session number 20485, John, or as he prefers to be known, Joe Stringer, Reel 1.
Joe Stringer, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Brown Hills, a small village about 6 miles from Walsall here.
Which year was this?
1923.
Did you grow up in Brown Hills?
Yes, I spent all my early days in the village of Brown Hills.
And how old were you when you left school?
14.
Did you get a job?
I did get a job, yes. Painting and decorating.
So, is that the job you were doing when war was declared?
Yes, I was.
Did you hear Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did.
Under what circumstances?
I can't honestly recall what I was doing at the time, but I remember him declaring war.
How did you feel about it?
At that age, I don't think I'd got any strong feelings.
Did the war affect you at first?
Inasmuch as my elder brother was in the local territorial branch of the Royal Engineers, and he was called up immediately on the outbreak of war.
Were you in any early bombing of England by the German Air Force?
We had a few bombs in the district, yes. One occasion, one very close to my fiancée, who is now my wife, and we finished up in the ditch. I had to throw her in the ditch. But apparently, Chase Water, which was in those days was known as Norton Pool, we were told that the German bombers used it when flying to Coventry for direction finding. And apparently, a few bombs were jettisoned in this area when planes couldn't make their immediate target.
Were you ever frightened in the bombing?
I don't think I was frightened. I felt exhilarated, I think, more than frightened. The little that we did come in contact with it. I honestly don't think I was frightened. I was exhilarated. I mean, at 15 and 16 years of age, it's a bit of excitement, I think.
Can you tell me about joining up, please?
Certainly. I volunteered for the Royal Marines, much to the disgust of my family, my father, and his six brothers were previously in the First World War, all in the same company of Royal Engineers that my elder brother served in the Second World War. They felt I had betrayed the family.
So why did you volunteer for them?
I don't know. I felt I had a strong feeling for the notion of being on board ship and serving in that respect. Something unusual. It appealed to me.
How did you go about joining up?
As I say, I volunteered, went to Wolverhampton to the recruiting place there and volunteered for the Royal Marines.
And this is in which year?
It would be what? I joined in 1942, so it would be sometime in 41.
Can you tell me about being called up, please?
Yes, I received the notification that I had to report to Limston in Devon, and I made tracks to Walsall Railway Station, where I met a young fellow there for the first time, named Harold Pugh, and in conversation I found that we were both heading for Limston to join the Royal Marines. It was a bit tragic, really, later on, as Harold, although we drifted apart at one time in our careers in the Royal Marines, we came together when 48th Royal Marine Commando was formed. And we lost him. He was drowned in a road accident. He's driving a Jeep. He came off the road and finished up in canal, trapped under his jeep, and he was drowned. This was much later on. Later on, towards the end of the war, when we were training a Dehan for the Walcheren, which will come up much later in my story. But Harold was a dear friend, and it was a very tragic blow to me.
How did you get on with the training?
The initial training, very good. It's the first time I'd really left my home village here. I was very taken up with the beautiful scenery down in Devon, and there was certainly a fine bunch of young men that I joined up with, 332 Squadron, and I thoroughly enjoyed the training. I think I was had a military base somehow, it was instilled in me with my father and my uncles, most of my uncles rose to a senior NCO rank, and one in particular impressed on me that I must go for promotion, don't stick in the bottom. But when I joined at Glimston and saw the age and the experience of the NCOs there, I didn't think I had much chance. But this uncle promised me financial reward whenever I received a promotion. Small though it may be, half a crown or something like that. And this probably spurred me on.
What happened after Glimston?
After Glimston, I joined MNBDO, which was Marine Naval Base Defence Organisation, and I served on Beaufort's guns. After our initial training and firing at St Agnes in Cornwall, we were put on gun sites in South Wales, at Neath in South Wales, where we were there to protect an oil refinery. And later we moved to Haverford West on the approaches to Pembroke Dock.
Did you get promoted?
My first promotion was when it was looked as if I was a possible recruit for a NCO, was a Red Diamond. That was the first promotion. And then I was eventually promoted to Lance Corporal in the early days on the gun sites at Haverford West.
What was the meaning of the Red Diamond?
That was potential NCO, the first thing.
What happened to you after South Wales?
South Wales, we then moved on up to Greenock in Scotland, where we were bound for the Middle East. This is the whole of the MNBDO organisation. And we had rather a traumatic experience, in as much as the boat that we were put on, the SS Orduna, had just been fumigated, and it was in a shocking state. And furthermore, the merchant seamen on board were getting amongst all the members of MNBDO with the tales that various units had walked off this ship in disgust. The accommodation wasn't really good enough to carry all MNBDO too, which is a rather large organisation. And this was in February of 1944. Very cold. 43 February. It was snowing. It was very, very cold up in Scotland. But we were so disgusted that there was so much ill feeling moving amongst us that we walked off the ship and gathered on the quayside. Eventually, the brigadier, I think a fellow named Brigadier Leach Porter was the gentleman's name, appeared on the gangway and appealed to us all to come back on board for the good name of the Corps. Sling our hammocks anywhere, and he assured us that the ship wouldn't sail until such times as some of us, or preferably all the unit, were moved to another ship with far better accommodation. We didn't need much persuasion. We were cold, we were miserable, and so we flooded back on board. And we slung our hammocks where best we could, on deck, some of us. And we were tired, and we naturally fell asleep. Only to wake up next morning and find ourselves well out to sea, standing off Greenock, where we waited for the rest of the convoy to form up. We had, in point of fact, been shanghaied. This was going to be a very uncomfortable journey on this ship, but in true marine spirit, we set to clean the ship up and make it more livable. The only one consolation for me on board this ship and this journey around to the Middle East was the fact that as a Lance Corporal, there's no job on board ship with the Royal Marines. There's no such rank as Corporal on sea service marine occupation. So therefore, there was no job I could do. A job was formed for me in as much as they gave me the Derby Club. And I was given a small bunch of Royal Marines, a dozen or so Royal Marines, from the troop, allocated a section on the rear deck, the aft deck, and there I used to collect a few buckets and basins, baths, tin baths and soap, and I ran the Derby Club. Very pleasant for me to sit on the after deck there in the sunshine, travelling down the west coast of Africa, as long as the sun was shining, watching the flying fish and the dolphins, supervising my little team of washermen. But even so, it was a very, very uncomfortable journey. Cooking facilities on board the ship were very limited, and it appeared that the only hot meal we ever had was a stew. And they'd got large vats, and this was the only hot food they could prepare. Travelling down the west coast of Africa, we hit a very violent electric storm, and shortly afterwards, our ship, the SS Orduna, lost its steering capabilities, and we lost contact for 2 days with the rest of the convoy. So again, the merchant seamen were amongst us, telling us how many submarines there were in the area and how many sharks there were there, making it altogether a very uncomfortable journey. We had a very long journey. The convoy was twisting virtually to South America to avoid the ship. And due to the fact that one or two, we had called into Freetown for some supplies, and during that time, some members had gone over the side of the ship, gone ashore, not prepared to go on with the journey. And we were earlier being informed that we would have a break on this journey in South Africa, either at Cape Town or Durban. Well, we were due to pull into Cape Town. But as some members had gone over the side of the ship at Freetown, they said that we wouldn't be allowed ashore. But they did relent eventually, and we did have 2 marvellous days in Cape Town.
Did you know the people who went absent without leave?
No, they didn't belong to the unit that I was with. There were about 3,500 of us on board this ship, and they were from other units. Whether this was just hearsay or not, I don't know. The room is gone. But anyway, they did relent and allow us ashore at Cape Town, and the people there were marvellous to us. As you stepped down off the gangplank, you were met with the civilians, most of them people that had repatriated out from this country, expats from here, and they took us out to their homes on the suburbs of Cape Town, beautiful homes, and made us very welcome, and we had a very pleasant 2 or 3 days ashore. We then proceeded round to the Middle East, eventually arriving in Egypt, and were encamped in a tented encampment at Kassassin, a small village just outside Ismailia, We then did more training on the Bofors gun, and eventually we were led to understand that although we wouldn't take any part in the North African campaign, we were there for the invasion of Sicily and possibly carrying on up into Italy. It was at this time I was promoted corporal, and I think it was July the 13th, we eventually took part in the invasion of Sicily. It was a pretty easy invasion as far as we were concerned, much different to the ones that we were to have in our later service. We landed at Augusta Harbour, and we there did the job which we were trained to do as a Marine Naval Base Defence Organisation.
So did you experience enough firing?
Oh yes, we had air raids to contend with, and we made one or two claims of it, which were never confirmed, but other than that, we didn't see any actual hand fighting or anything like that. We were on these Bofors guns. Shortly after we landed there, I was promoted to sergeant and given my own Bofors gun crew. This was rather difficult, as a lot of the men who were under my command had served with me as Marines, and it's very difficult to take command of someone that's been with you since you joined up. But I don't think I made too many enemies. In fact, I'm still in touch with people. That was one in particular, a gentleman who served with me on that gun, and he got back in touch with me about 4 years ago, and he's a very good friend.
What was it like handling the Bofors?
It was quite enjoyable, although it's the one segment of my service history which I have difficulty remember a great deal about. It's sort of washed under with what came after when I joined commando. It's a sort of a part that I can easily forget. I'm more taken up with what came later on in my career in the Royal Marines. But anyway, we didn't go any farther from Sicily up into Italy, as it was decided back here that now the move was on to for D-Day, making preparations for D-Day. And the powers would be decided that there was a need for another commando unit. And it was decided that this commando unit would be formed from mainly the 7th Battalion Royal Marines and a few younger senior NCOs and officers from MNBDO. 7th Battalion Royal Marines was an infantry trained unit. MNBDO, as I previously said, were on ACAC guns, both light and heavy, and various other organisations within the MNBDO organisation. So we returned to the UK, arriving back late January 1944. The journey home was a much pleasanter journey than the one we went out on. Much shorter, on a much nicer ship. We came back on the, I must think, the Orion, the Queen of the Orient Line. And with my new status now as a senior NCO, I had the added advantage of a private cabin on board. But it was a very short journey, one that's much too young to appreciate. When we arrived back in Greenock, we were stationed for a few days at Paisley, and there we were told what was happened to all of us. We're given our directions. Those of us who were joining 48 Commando were told so, and where we had to report back to. The rest of them who were staying with MNBDO were given, as we all were, 14 days disembarkation leave. And I arrived home on February 16th, 1944, which was in fact my 21st birthday. We spent 14 days very enjoyable at home. And during this time, I'd previously been engaged while I was abroad by proxy. My fiancée and I discussed it and we decided we would get married. And she asked me, could I suggest a date for our future wedding? And I suggested June, sometime early in June. And I was convinced that D-Day then would have been over and my fate would have been settled. This was agreed and all the arrangements were made. And after my 14 days, I reported back to Deal as instructed. And there I met for the first time Lieutenant Colonel Jim Moulton, who was to play a very big part in my next 2 years of my life. Together with the rest of 48 Commando, he addressed us and told us that we had a very short time for preparation for what we were going to do later in the year. And after about 14 days in Deal, in preparation, we boarded the train bound for Achnacarry in Scotland, the commando training centre. And after a 25-hour journey to Achnacarry, we arrived at Spainbridge Station. We lived on that journey on packed food and we were feeling rather tired and we disembarked at Spainbridge Station and inquired where was the transport. And we were pointed towards the Commando Bagpipe Band and we were informed that this was our transport to Achnacarry House, a distance of 7 miles. So together with all our gear, this was our introduction to commando training. And we marched the 7 miles, and we had to march, we were marching to Achnacarry House. We eventually arrived there, rather tired and bedraggled and pretty low-spirited. Paraded on the ground, and immediately on the ground, Bren guns opened up just above our heads on fixed lines. And the instructors were walking along with their pace sticks, knocking your legs behind you, get down, you fools. Anyway, this was a good introduction to commando training. We got a very short condensed course, and our instructors were the Lovett Scouts, a fine body of men, and really impressed on us the job we had to do. It was very, very arduous training. We were in constant bivouacs, two to a bivouac, and the weather was, as one could expect, February, was a bit rough, wet and miserable. But every morning, you were always expected to turn out smart and clean on parade, and the moment you'd been inspected, you'd be sent through the mud bath to make you feel comfortable for the rest of the day. And you'd be wet through all the day, all day, clambering the mountains, abseiling down cliffs, spending some nights spending out on the mountains. A very arduous job. As I say, our training was condensed. We had so short a time we couldn't have the normal length of commando training. But as we'd seen some active service, they thought, apart from giving us this hard feeling, which was necessary physically, this is all they could do to get us prepared for the job we had to do. Eventually, those of us that made the course, finished the course, which you were not forced to do, at any time you could go to the CO and ask to be returned to your unit, and so you could be, without any stain on your character at all. But those of us that had seen it through to the end were given our much coveted green berry. We left Achnacarry bound for Gravesend, the town that adopted us, and there again we had another privilege, along with our green berry. we were put into civilian billets. And the comfort of nice, homely billets, and the friendship still exists with the people of Gravesend and 48th Royal Marine Commando. We continued our training on the Cooling Marshes, and I, as number two section commander, I'd maintained my rank of sergeant and was given number two section in B Troop. And two section of each troop was designated as the demolition section. So I, together with my section, was sent on an engineering and demolition course with the Royal Engineers. And we used an old disused quarry for a lot of our training. Okay. And we used this quarry for our training, and the Royal Engine instructors gave us various jobs to do there, and there was lots of debris and odd equipment lying about there. And on one particular occasion there was a long jib arm of a crane lying there, and my section and me were given the job to cut a section out of this, assuming that it was a bridge, and we had to cut a section out. And the object was to use as little explosive as possible, make as little noise, but do the job. So we set the charge up, and the Royal Engineer officer in charge of us came down, inspected it, saw that everything was okay, and we eventually blew it very successfully. The centre section was cut out beautifully, and this quarry was alongside what I could only think would be, in Kent, a stretch of water. What would it be?
The River Thames?
No, not the Thames.
The Medway.
The Medway. And at the time, there was flying boats using it for landing, whatever. And just as we blew this thing, this piece of steel flew up into the air, and this flying boat was just taking off. Landed very, very close to it. To us, it appeared close. Obviously, it wasn't that close, but it looked it to us. But anyway, there's no repercussion over this. But the repercussion came the following day. As part of our training, the engineer section was trained to use the Life Buoy flamethrower. This is a sort of like a spare wheel of a motor, which you had on your back, and a sort of a torch operating at the front, which you used. And we were using this, and the engineers were demonstrating this tool to us, and we were in a sort of a dip in the dunes alongside this river, and this gentleman came storming over the top, expressing the fact that he didn't want to witness our plaything that we'd got, but he wanted to know who'd cut the jib arm in two. Apparently he'd bought it off the ministry a few days previously, and he'd come to pick it up, and we found it was yours. I don't know how the officer in charge went on about it, but it has nothing to do with us, obviously. We'd been given instructions to do it. But that's just a little thing that happened to us. We also did street clearing training at this time using the bombed quarter of Limehouse in London. We practiced landings with the people that we were due to land with at Littlehampton. We did a mock invasion there with the Canadian North Shore Regiment and the Ford Garry Horse. These were the people that we were to be closely associated with during the D-Day invasion. Eventually the time came to move out after one or two false exercises which we gave the impression that we were going, but they were false. And we gave the impression that the final one was false. To our landladies, we were just going on an exercise. We left the majority of our kit back in our civilian billets. We just took what was necessary, and we headed for Southampton, a marshalling camp in Southampton, on the main road just outside Southampton, where we were billeted in this tented camp, where we were going to receive our final instructions for our part in the D-Day invasion. This was early in June, and it became apparent to me then that I shouldn't make June the 3rd back home for my wedding. I approached my CO, Lieutenant Colonel Moulton. Could he inform me?